Hi again, folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Property Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajimam again. Great to have you back with us today. Before we get right into this episode, which is going to be a bit long, you should be forewarned, just a quick heads up on an arrangement that we've reached with OFX. So OFX is a foreign exchange trader. They're one of those people who help you move funds overseas from whichever account you've got in whichever country, if you've got another account in another country, or alternatively, to make payments to any third party within that country, even if you don't actually have a bank account there. So as long as one of the sides in the transaction is an account under your name, you can use their services. The rates are much, much better than the banks. So usually the banks will only provide a daily rate, whereas the rates actually change every 10 minutes or so. So the bank sets a rate that is 5% above or under, depending on the direction in which they make the conversion, just to cover themselves for any rate fluctuations. Plus, they charge a huge margin and fees, so it can come up to much more than 5% if you book an international transfer with your bank. So it's always a good idea to sign up with a Forex provider if you're going to be transferring funds overseas. Definitely in case of bigger transfers, let's say over $1,000 or so, but you can do that from as little as $250. And the arrangement that we've got with OFX is that any clients referred by us, regardless of whether their transactions have anything to do with us as a company, any clients referred by us will enjoy fee-free transfers. So not only will you get the much improved rates in comparison with a bank, you'll also be fee-free on every transaction under your account, as long as your account is flagged as having been referred by us. So we'll put the sign up link in this episode's show notes. It's absolutely free of charge to sign up. You just need to provide a few documents to prove your identity, and off you go. Okay, so without further ado, we're going to dive right into it. This episode is actually a recording of a business call that we've had with a potential client, or a client now. He was a potential client at the time of the recording. And this is a really extended sort of Q&A session. It's almost an hour long, and it covers all aspects of what this particular client was interested in. So we're talking about things like how properties are priced, which locations are better, what to do with a certain budget, a bit about the monthly mansion, which is the rent by the month arrangement versus long-term lease, and also versus real short-term leases, Airbnb types, which is called Minpaku in Japan. We cover the advantages, the disadvantages, the operational sides, fees involved at every stage of the management, and so forth. So really, this episode is really packed full of really yummy information. Enjoy, and I'll see you on the other side.
The main reasons why I've sort of found the Japanese real estate market really interesting is for three things that I have noticed is that the for a lot of the prices for houses, I've noticed that they're lower priced in Japan. On average, I would say maybe compared to here in Canada. And another thing I've noticed is the occupancy rate is, especially in some parts like Tokyo, have been really good, as well as the rental income. So those are three things that I've noticed, which has really drawn me towards the Japanese real estate market. So and that's why I was inquiring with you a lot about the Minpaku setup, yep. as we had talked about a lot over the email. So when I looked at some of the potential, so that's why I was mostly looking at. But it sounds like it can be very, very complicated. And I wanted to make sure, like, we know every, because it sounds like there's a lot of things to know in order to get to that, in order to be able to do something like that.
Well, they've made it that way recently. It was a lot easier until June last year, and then they've changed it for a lot of reasons. Some of it is because the hotel lobby was pushing them to cut the competition out, and a part of it because neighbors were complaining or building management companies were complaining. But I'll just a few caveats on what you said just before. So prices in Tokyo and central Osaka specifically are not that low anymore. So they have gone up. I think Tokyo is now almost at its pre-bubble level. So like back in the early 1990s, we had the bubble burst here, and property prices have been going down since then. Since I think the middle of last year, again, Tokyo prices are almost at that level again.
I see. Yeah, so we're seeing another bubble now.
I wouldn't call it a bubble just yet, because the rest of the country still has a very long way to go, and I don't think Tokyo and Osaka will go much further upwards because of that psychological barrier and because yields are very depressed there now. But specifically, central Tokyo and central Osaka are not that cheap anymore. Other places in the country still are, and including some big cities, but not central Tokyo and Osaka. That's the only caveat. As with occupancy as well, it really depends on the types of property you're looking at. So if we're talking about long-term leases, we'll get into short-term in a second, but if we're talking about long-term leases, central city occupancies are quite high on newish, largish apartments. If you're looking at older, because you were looking online on some pretty old houses from memory. So
yes.
So those is really a touch and go. It depends on where they are and how well they're renovated and how much you're asking for rent. So it's not all rosy. Just to give you a rough idea. So with So with short-term leasing, Minpaku, which is the real short-term holiday type stay where you charge by the day or by the week, that's been heavily regulated now. The general nationwide regulation says that you can't rent this place out for more than half the year in this way. So you can use the rest of the year in other ways, but short-term stay is only up to half the year. And then each particular ordinance and city hall has their own regulations about which areas and which types of properties and how they need to be set up. And you can get around a lot of the headaches if you set up a company and license yourself as a hotel operator or an inn operator. In itself is not too much of a difficult and expensive process, but then the property has to be set up in a certain way that will allow you to get that license to operate an inn or a hotel at that address. So none of it is insurmountable, and people are doing this, and it's definitely doable, but it takes a bit more capital and a bit more planning, and it takes choosing the right kind of property to make it work. And the other option is monthly rental. So as long as you rent for a minimum period of 1 month, and you've got a standard lease in place, then you don't need to comply with any special regulations. If you own an apartment in a residential building, the building management company and the owner's corporation might complain or try to make it longer leases just to avoid people moving in and out too much. But legally, there's not much that they can do about it. They can just cause some headaches for the property manager, but that's about it.
Yeah, and I was looking at some of the links you had provided, which showed some of the current areas on the market on rent, available for rent for monthly rentals.
Yep.
And so that's the thing I was wondering about. So I guess if there is more availability for doing monthly rentals for properties, is it how much? Different would it be in terms of the rental income you would that potential rental income you can get from monthly rental as opposed to, let's say, long term rental or as opposed to daily rental? What is it like with in terms of the difference and I guess also the expenses?
Well, it really depends on the location. If it's in a good location, even in seasonal areas, places that are dependent on, say, like, you know, by the beach for summer tourism or snowy areas for winter tourism, even those kinds of places tend to, if they're well located, meaning within a reasonable walking distance to a nearby station, usually generate, I'd say, about net pre-tax, about double the long-term lease potential. So if we look at Tokyo, for example, usually your standard apartment will yield about 4 or 5% if you're lucky for standard leases. So if you lease it out by the month and it's in a good location, you'll probably make at least double that. So we're talking about, say, 9 or 10% if you rent it out by the month. And that's including all of the expenses. So the management company charges more, and you obviously have to pay for internet and electricity and water. But then the guest also pays you back for that. And the management company only charges you when the place is rented. So all things included, you can probably double your income if the property is well located.
Okay, and the management and utility fee, is that covered by the tenant, or is that usually? Because I think when a tenant books a rental unit, there's a management and a utility fee.
Yes, that's right. So the guests pay for cleaning, they pay for water and electricity, a fixed fee, but it's a fixed fee that definitely covers you. And that includes internet as well. So that's all covered. The only thing, and the management company only charges you when the place is occupied. So they only get paid, they charge usually 25 to 30% depending on the company. But they only take that from the money that comes in from the guest as well. So the only thing you'll be up for if the property is vacant is the building fees. If you're owning an apartment in a co-owned block, so you've got your monthly, I think you call them HOA in Canada, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you've got your monthly management fee for the building and the reserve fund contribution. So those two components still have to be paid even if the unit is vacant. But that's the case with any apartment.
Okay. And what about insurance? How is that? Is there... insurance costs as well for any sort of damages or structural maintenance?
So structural maintenance, that depends on whether you're owning. Are you talking about a house or an apartment in a co-owned building?
I guess for a house would make more sense to have an outside insurance, another insurance.
Yeah, so if you're owning a unit in a co-owned building, meaning there's a owner's corporation and there's a building management company, so the structural and communal expenses for the building go out of the reserve fund pool. So the money that you pay every month, the reserve fund contributions are supposed to cover all of that. In some cases, or as the building gets old, they're going to raise the monthly fees to compensate for big renovations and stuff like that. So over time, you do tend to pay a little bit more. If it's a house... if you own the entire building, then you're in charge of everything. It's all your responsibility. In which case, the insurance costs a little bit more. But insurance is very cheap in Japan in any case. For the apartments, we're talking about... for tiny studio apartments, we're talking about something like 5,000 yen, so about $50 for 5 years.
That's
ridiculously funny. Cheap for the interior.
Yeah.
As the apartment gets bigger, the insurance costs a bit more, but it's still very, very small amounts. If you need to cover the structure as well, it's a little bit more, but still very reasonable. While we're talking, I'll just have a quick look at a house that one of our customers owned, and I'll tell you how much that works out to be. But go ahead, keep talking.
Okay. Yeah, also I was wondering, what about for houses especially? Is there like insurance for earthquakes or other natural disasters? Are those insurances available, or are those expensive?
Not all insurance policies include coverage for natural disasters, but up to a point. So I think from memory, if it's a total loss case, you get 50% of the value.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And if it's smaller damages, it's somewhere between 25 to 50%, depending on how much damage was caused to the... So it's really a case of... So the compensation would be coming from three sources. It'd be coming from the... If it's a unit in a co-owned building, so obviously if the building is demolished or destroyed by an earthquake, the reserve fund pool is then distributed between the owners.
I see.
Minus the expense that it takes to clear the rubble and all that, and your insurance policy will cover you for up to 50% of the value of the apartment itself. And then if it's a man-made disaster, say like the nuclear spillage they had at Fukushima, then there will be government compensation to some level, but that usually takes a good few years to get. So it's a case of, it's really a case, whether it'll be completely paid for or not is a case of how long you are getting income from it before that happened.
I see. Okay. And this is true for both houses and co-owned buildings.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. So up to 50% in case of total loss, that part is guaranteed, and the rest of it depends on the situation.
I see. Okay. And what is there a risk for any collateral? I know, like, there's no, the only really any fees are the building management fees in case of vacancies. But sometimes, like in here in Canada, like usually when bank lends you a mortgage, gives you a mortgage, usually there's collateral on the house in case. Sometimes, if those payments are not made, eventually they have the right to seize of the property. So those kind of collateral.
Yeah, if you don't pay your property tax, the government can at some stage. I mean, it's never happened to anyone that we worked with, but I think legally they are entitled to seize the property if you don't pay taxes for a few years.
I see. Okay.
Taxes are pretty low here as well, though. I think they work out to be somewhere between 0.5% to 1.5% of the purchase price per year. So on the studio units, for example, you're looking at something like between $200 to $400 a year. And the bigger, the more expensive the property, the more it is. Aside from that, no. So building, if you don't pay your building fees, building management might cut the water and the electricity to the unit.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But they can actually seize the property now.
Okay, I see. Yeah. I think it's similar to here in Canada as well. It's mostly just really it's the property tax you have collateral on, and in case of a house loan, through a mortgage, and I'm assuming that's the same case for mortgages, house loans in Japan as well.
Yes, there are foreclosures in Japan, not as much as in other countries. They will try to avoid that as long as they can, but they do exist, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm just looking now at, just to give you an example of old house in Sapporo City, for example. So this is something that our customer has. That's 125 square meter, cubic meter house on 192 square meter land. Five bedrooms plus living, dining, and kitchen built in 1973, so fairly old.
And
that one, insurance on that one costs about $30 a month.
Oh, okay, that's quite good.
Yeah, it's not really expensive. Yeah. And I'll give you one more little example of a customer that has a building, so a multifamily, like a six-unit block. And
that five bedroom you mentioned, is that that's a rental property or is that a residential
Leasing it to a family, yeah.
Oh, to one family, right?
It's a big house for, I think it's a single mom with two or three kids.
Okay.
Is the tenant, and she's been very good. She's been with him for years, and he just gave her a bonus. He clears the snow off the roof and around the house in the winter, and she's very happy with that. So she's probably going to stay forever, I think. Let me just give you another little example. Just give me a sec. So this one is also fairly recent, towards the end of last year. This is a six-unit block here in Fukuoka City.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is so similar, 120 square meters on 125 plot of land, six units of six studio units with a loft and a kitchen, and he's paying $70, roughly $70 US dollars a month for insurance, including the structure.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So it's insurance in general. I mean, especially compared to the property value, it's actually quite more affordable than how it is in here in Canada.
Yes, but I'm guessing coverage would be a bit different. You probably get you probably get the 100% back if anything happens, right?
Yeah, in most cases, yeah. I mean, there are some other things like in terms of leakage or in terms that you need to pay more in order to cover those type of things.
Yeah.
But generally, yeah, the basic coverage, yeah, they would pay you, I think, almost 100%.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the policies are expendable to 100%. We never had anyone ask for that because the price does go up significantly if you go for that. From our experience, I mean, I shouldn't say that this is going to be always the case because this is Japan and we do get earthquakes here. But from our experience in just about 200 properties under management now, we've only ever had a customer out of pocket about $500 for a bent window frame or something.
Yeah.
But that's just statistically, it's bound to happen sooner or later. So I shouldn't actually get you hopeful with that.
Yeah. And the other thing that, since you mentioned that, is that I think we mentioned the depreciation of property in terms of how quickly, or I guess we were talking about how quickly the properties in Japan tend to depreciate after about 25 or 30 years. So is that the case for all properties, or does it depend on the type of structure?
Depends on the structure. So let's separate depreciation for tax purposes and practical depreciation, meaning the building is no longer usable. So with the wooden and metal frame structures, which is most of the older houses and the smaller unit blocks, that's 25 or 27 years from memory for tax purposes. And you will need to renovate and repair them on a regular basis. With the houses, parts of the house, as the years go by, parts of the house usually get completely rebuilt.
I see.
And with the smaller unit blocks, I would say practically you can probably keep them going for, say, 40 or 50 years. After that, it's probably going to be more cost efficient to tear it down and build a smaller new one. With the reinforced concrete building, so for example, if you own a unit in a larger building that's co-owned, let's say 50 or 80 or 100 units, those places for tax purposes have a lifespan of 47 years. Practically, they are maintained far longer than that. The oldest building that we've got, I think, is 1972. I think I mentioned that in an email, and that's been very well renovated because it's a very central location and it's a very big property. So for a developer to tear it down and compensate, I think that one has about 200 units in the complex. So for a developer to tear it down and then compensate 200 unit owners is going to be a fortune. Plus the cost of demolishing something.
So it hasn't been rebuilt yet, so it's been there since 1972.
Yes, and it's in very good shape. They're going to keep renovating it till kingdom come.
Okay.
So practically, theoretically, for tax purposes, it's already depreciated completely. Practically, I don't see it going anywhere in the next 20 years at least.
Okay. Yeah, because this was one of the things when I was doing my own search at in terms of trying to find a property there, that was one of the things that I was starting to look at. I guess the ones that I was looking at was about maybe 22 years old.
Yep.
And that was one of the things that came into my mind that maybe the price largely might just be fluctuating depending on the year they were built. And it could be that maybe there might be some structural renovation that might be required, and maybe that's why the some of the properties in the market are much lower priced, especially when you look at the area, even in busy areas like within Tokyo itself.
It depends also on what the property is used for. Here, it's a bit counterintuitive to other countries. Here, investment properties, meaning properties that the owner can afford to buy but would never want to live in. So let's say the older, smaller units. Investment properties are priced almost entirely on the rental income that they can fetch. So if the economy doesn't do well and tenants aren't paying as much rent, or let's say if new developments came up in the area, which pushes down rent for the older developments, and then the price of the property will drop as well, because it's obviously not going to be a property that somebody's going to buy to live in, right? Because somebody who can afford to pay for a property here would usually buy something a lot more comfortable than these. But for investment purposes, they're cash cows, so that's what people like to invest in. And on the other hand, properties that are definitely owner-occupied, meaning properties that are not going to be generating a lot of money for rental income because they're bigger, or they're fancier, or they're new, they're in relatively well-maintained buildings. These properties can be priced depending on whatever the market does, like in other countries. So if an area is popular, people want to live there, they want to buy properties there, so the property is gonna go up in price. And that's always going to be regardless of the structure. So the structure depreciates fairly quickly in Japan for tax purposes. But if the economy does well and the value of the land goes up, that's usually going to surpass whatever the property is lost. So that's what's been happening in Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka in the last 6-7 years.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's interesting to know. So if you get have a property in central area, like in Tokyo, even if the property is depreciated or let's say it's quite old, it was just the value of the land alone would be would still be beneficial, even with the cost involved in, let's say, doing renovations and rebuilding the entire structure.
At this point in time, yes. Knowing that Japan's just come out of 25 odd years of deflation, I wouldn't bank on that to be a long term thing. I mean, it really depends on what Japan. I mean, the population here is declining. One of the fastest places, I think second fastest in the world, definitely the fastest of the larger developed nations. So the population is in fast decline. The economy has been doing well for the last 6-7 years, but because the workforce is shrinking,
tourism has been increasing. Tourism has in general been increasing, isn't it?
Yeah, tourism has definitely been increasing, and it's probably going to continue to do that. But the country's GDP generally, and it's heavy reliant on exports. When the workforce is shrinking, even the inflation that they have managed to achieve in the last 6-7 years, which I think is about 1.5% per year at best, whether that's going to be a long-term trend or not is anyone's guess. So, plus, they say that a big earthquake is due to hit Tokyo in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, and that when that happens, I'm guessing property prices will definitely go down again. So I wouldn't count on Japan as a capital growth market. I mean, I wouldn't structure your investments based only on that. Make sure that the cash flow works as well.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. I don't want to present a picture that's too rosy, because that's going to come back to bite both you and me on the bum.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and this is exactly why I'm actually want to that's why I wanted to get in touch with you to try and find out the caveats and those these kind of things are actually important information when making my decision. So yeah,
and don't get me wrong, we've got some customers with properties in Tokyo, Yokohama, Kawasaki, so around Tokyo as well. As well as some smaller bedroom communities that are up to, say, 45 minutes or 1 hour by train, which are also very popular for rental income. And we do have a couple of customers with properties in Osaka and Kobe. So around those areas, we do. But the vast majority of them usually target places that can provide a little bit more cash flow while still having some potential growth, but not as the main criteria.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, even for me, the main thing I was interested also in terms of, instead of looking for the long-term growth, I was seeing, focusing more on the cash flow opportunities that are available in Japan.
Yep. No, if you're going the monthly mansion route, if you're going to be renting out by the month, definitely your cash flow will be higher wherever you're going to end up buying. So that's not... You're not going to be at a case of break-even or negative gearing territory at all, but you could get higher cash flow in other places, right? Like a last monthly mansion-type property that we facilitated for a customer is in Itoshima, so that's a beach community. Should have been pretty vacant during the winter and the autumn, but for some reason it's doing well, and he's making, I think, now about, on average, 13 net before tax. 13%. Long-term lease on that property would probably get him about half of that, and that's a seasonal one. So you can definitely boost your income with monthly mansion. You can also start with a standard long-term lease, and if you're not happy with the returns, next time that tenant moves out, then switch to monthly mansion or vice versa. if it looks like it's too much of a hassle or it's not popular enough to justify the hassle, you can go back to a long-term lease.
And do you have clients who are able to generate, with good properties, are able to generate enough income to sustain, let's say, sustain their lifestyle just through the rental income?
We do, but those are usually people that have invested in quite a few properties. So somebody who's got, let's say, a few small buildings, let's say up to a total of 20 to 30 doors in total, can probably live off that quite comfortably. I mean, it depends on your lifestyle, obviously, and Canada is a more expensive place to live than Japan, but it does exist. But it's not going to be on the base of, I wouldn't say it's going to be on the base of one property. But you mentioned a budget of about 200,000 US, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I would say you probably need a bit more than that to live just on that.
Yeah.
But over the course of, say, if you recycle that money and you invest in the similar sort of budget every, say, 5 or 6 years, then maybe after 15 years or so, it'll. But you've also got your, hopefully you've also got your equity and cash flow in Canada as well, right?
Yeah, my main consideration is definitely including the portfolio I have here in Canada. I'm still in the midst of paying both properties off. I'm actually have paid off, or I will be paying off one of my properties. So the other property will I still have to pay off. But eventually, my consideration is definitely taking. Taking both of those properties into consideration, and also if I can find a good cash flowing property in Japan, and that's the main thing I was actually looking at, and comparing the cash flow I can get from, let's say, if I buy a third property here, and I think maybe if there's a better opportunity for finding a cash flowing investment property in Japan, then I think it's worth just trying to look in the Japanese market instead of the market here.
Well, the cash flow in Japan will definitely be higher than Canada. I don't know, you know, if we're lucky, capital growth might be good down the track as well. But even if not, the cash flow will definitely be higher here. And I'm not sure, are Canadian tenants like U.S. tenants? Like if it's a low income bracket, are they troublesome or are they relatively hands-off, like hassle-free tenants?
Yeah, there can be. It's not that different, but it depends on if you have a good property management. They will do their credit checks, and usually finding good tenants so far has not been a problem for me. My property management here has been able to do a good job of doing credit checks and finding tenants that I've never had any trouble getting the rent from the long-term tenants. Most of my tenants have been also family oriented, who are renting long-term. Yep. So if you do, this would be my, if you do go with this, go with a monthly rental, this would be my first experience having different types of tenants who are more focused on short-term, maybe monthly rentals. So
well, they're not a problem rent-wise because they pay everything in advance, right? That's not an issue at all.
Yeah. Okay.
The point I was trying to make is that the Japanese tenants are probably similar to that experience that you've had in Canada from that respect. So the main reasons people usually come to invest here is for the higher cash flow, for the more affordable properties. Again, central Tokyo and Osaka aside, the properties are more affordable here. And for hassle-free tenants and management, because, I mean, here there's no danger of anyone screwing you. I mean, some people are late to pay the rent, and, you know, worst case, they don't pay for a few months. You send them a letter and out they go. You never have to forcibly evict anyone or anything like that.
And also, speaking of the affordable properties, so there are sometimes in some rare cases you'll see online where in even central locations like in Tokyo, you'll find properties within that are actually quite cheaper than what you would expect. And sometimes it's hard to tell what's the factor that's making these cheaper. Why are they on the market for so long? what is the main criteria to look for in these type of properties? Because, for example, though I showed you one, I think maybe it was in within pretty quite central in Tokyo, and it was, I think, within the budget that we were looking at in 20 million.
Yep.
And I guess maybe it might be the, it was quite old. I don't know. I think maybe if we're looking at like 1995, 1997, I'm not sure if that's a factor. But
it depends on the condition of the house. 95 to 97 usually wouldn't be too old for a house. So there might be something specifically wrong with that one. In other cases, it might be that the building regulations have changed and that land parcel just doesn't allow you to build as much as it used to when they built that house. So when it does come time to tear it down, you might find that you can only turn it into a parking lot, for example. Or build a small shop or something there. So long term, the income potential might be lower if you have to rebuild. Other factors that could affect is the walking distance to a nearby station. If it's beyond 10 or 15 minutes, it becomes a lot less popular with tenants. And lastly, if somebody died in the property, that takes the price down significantly as well. Japanese are very sensitive about that. So if you're going to turn it into something the tourists are going to stay in, they usually wouldn't mind. But if you're going to have a standard Japanese tenant and the next one after a death has to be informed, and even after that, a neighbor or somebody might tell them that somebody died in that property 5 or 10 years ago. And that also reduces the price significantly.
Oh, I see. So for short-term tenants, it's not as much of a problem as it is for if you have a family who are living long-term there.
No, that's correct. And again, if you're aiming for Tokyo or Osaka, I definitely go the monthly mansion way. Otherwise, your cash flow will be very low. If you get out to the suburbs or the surrounding satellite cities, then you can maybe get 6-7% even with standard long-term lease. Otherwise, you want monthly mansion.
Monthly mansion, yeah, and I think that does sound like probably the best way and the easiest way to do it. Because I'm also looking for something that's more hands-free, and I think it's more ideal than. Something like trying to, for example, the daily rental setup, it sounds like it would be a lot more headache involved in trying to get that as opposed to monthly rental.
Well, you need to hire staff, that's the thing. Because you don't live there close to the property yourself, somebody has to satisfy the, I think it's, depending on the location, but it's usually something like 500 or 800 meter within the walking distance to the property. There has to be someone available 24 hours.
Okay. And most of the times they won't really bother unless there's at least 8 to 9 different tenants.
It's not going to be worth your while because to satisfy the minpaku, it's going to be worth your while if you're a mom and dad type operator, right? So if you're living in the property or close to the property and you're handling check-ins and check-outs yourself and you hire local cheap cleaners and you find the cheap cleaning materials to put in the property for the tenants to use and stuff like that, it's worth your while at any size. But if you're a remote hands-off investor and you have to outsource all of these services, so if you're going to be doing it without a company set up, you can only do it for half the year, and then the other half you also have to somehow find a way to populate it. And then you have to hire a management company to do all of that for you. And if you're setting up a company and applying for a hotel license, which means that you're going to be able to operate it all throughout the year, you have to fully outsource all of these services. So it's just you're not going to be making more than a monthly mansion type setup unless you've got at least 9 or 10 rooms.
Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't sound as much hands-free.
It's not hands-free.
Yeah,
it's definitely not hands-free. The monthly mansion is hands-free in the sense that, you'll get reports to say, the management company will provide reports to us telling us what the booking situation is like for the next few months and if it's been vacant, if there's been anything that we needed to maintain or what. But otherwise, it is hands-free. With the minpaku, with the short term, you constantly have to be on top of things, yes.
And is it very flexible to switch between, let's say, between monthly mansion and long term, or is it? I guess whenever if tenants move out, you can always choose to be flexible on that, right?
That's right. So to opt out of monthly mansion is relatively simple. I mean, the most that somebody will renting the unit out like that would be for a year. And usually it's going to be periods of 1 or 2 or 3 months at most. So that's fairly liquid. To go from long-term tenancy towards monthly mansion, you have to have a tenant move out. So the leases are typically two-year terms and rolling leases. So unless anybody notifies anything, they just get renewed automatically after 2 years. Legally, you're not supposed to kick out a tenant without just cause. Practically, if you send them a letter to say that you're going to be using the property for something else and they need to move out, they're not going to take you to court over it. Unless it's a foreign tenant. If it's a foreign tenant, they're far more court-friendly. The Japanese don't like to go to court. Like, they avoid conflict at all costs. Yeah. So you send them a letter, they'll move out. If you got a foreign tenant, a long-term foreign tenant in there, they might give you a bit of trouble if you ask them to move out at the end of the lease.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's good to know. So, yeah, I guess for within the budget of, let's say, as we mentioned, about $200,000, what would you recommend in terms of for a monthly mansion? Is it better to, for a cash flow property, is it better to go towards an apartment or a split house type of property?
I would say the apartment would be more manageable and probably yield a bit more on the cash flow front. Plus, it's more stable as far as expenses are concerned. You're not going to suddenly have to, you know, get a new roof or what.
Yeah.
The only thing is, if you are thinking long term and you want to in the future get creative with the property, and maybe, you know, you might be a full time property investor, you might decide to visit Japan twice a year, and maybe you will want to turn it into a minpaku. So you're not going to have that option with an apartment. That's the only thing. You stand to gain less in value because you've got a smaller land plot. You only get a fraction of the land that the building is standing on. And you can't get creative with it. I mean, with a house, you can always, if it gets too expensive to maintain, you can always tear it down, turning it to a parking lot, build a warehouse and rent it out to an internet business that does deliveries within the city. There's always creative stuff to do with the land. An apartment is always going to be an apartment. You're not going to be, I mean, you can choose between long-term lease or monthly mansion, but that's it.
I see. And is it within that budget, is it easy to find houses or, I guess it depends on the area, right?
It depends on the area and depends on the condition of the house and the year of the build. So the place that you marked, I can't remember. Do you remember the walking distance to a station, that example that you sent to me?
I can't remember which station it was. I think it was 5 or 10 minutes. It was a three-floor house.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what the setup exactly. The pictures didn't really, there was no blueprint or pictures of the house didn't really show if there was a bathroom on each floor. I'm not sure if that's even standard or if there's a shared bathroom amongst the three floors and
With a house, your options are as follows. So one is a long-term lease. That's probably the least pain in the bum to manage, but it's the lowest cash flow. The other option is one tenant, long-term lease. Other option is to rent it out by the month, but also to a single tenant. So in that case, your tenant pool just gets a lot smaller because not many people want to rent an entire house unless they're coming here with a family for a few months and they're, I mean, they do exist, but it you might be looking at longer vacancies between these types of tenants.
Yeah.
And the other option is to renovate and restructure the place so that you can rent out rooms by the month.
So that's, I see. What would the restructuring involve? Would it be like try to make a...
just partitions, doors. The toilet is connected to one room, you need to make sure that it's accessible from the public areas. Same goes for the bathroom. You need to make sure that the kitchen is structured to allow 5 or 6 or 7 people to use it simultaneously. So you might need to enlarge the kitchen and just freshen it up a bit. So it wouldn't, your capital outlay wouldn't end with those $200,000, right? You'll have to put in more money to make it livable for five or six people that don't actually live together.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But again, owning a house gives you more creative freedom far down the track. If you look at a 10 or 20 year plan, owning an apartment is not going to, I mean, your income is not going to improve with an apartment. And once the place becomes too old, you want to sell it before, it, you know, once the cash flow starts going down significantly, let's say 15 years down the track, you want to start consider reselling it because there's not much else that you can do with it.
I see.
With the house, 15, 20 years down the track, all options are still open. You can do a lot of things with that land plot.
I see, yeah. And is the, let's say if you have a house and you split, if you do do the renovations to split it between multiple tenants, is sort of the draw from the income you get from a tenant per month, is it usually the same as if they were to rent an apartment? Or I guess it would probably be less if they're sharing it between multiple other tenants.
Well, the attraction for tenants is there's no limiting contract. I mean, they pay by the month. They can move out at any time. Whereas if they rent an entire apartment, they're obliged to stay there for at least 2 years. Otherwise, they have to pay an early vacating fee, which is, again, 1 or 2 months of rent. And the move-in fees are typically a lot cheaper. When they rent in a long-term lease on an apartment, they have to pay, in Tokyo, there's still this annoying custom called the Reikin thank you fee. So a lot of the owners or the real estate agents will charge them 1 month non-refundable, just like a contract signing lease, plus the contract signing fee itself, which is another month, plus 1 or 2 months of a security deposit. So it works out to be our and more money for changing the key and the lock, and more money for a cleaning deposit. So there are a lot of move-in fees that are just not applicable to a monthly rental type of thing. So that's attractive to tenants. The other thing is some tenants have just moved into the country after a stint overseas, or they're between jobs, or they're running their own business and their tax returns are pretty low, so they can't actually qualify for a standard apartment. So the best that they can do is rent a house in a rent a room in a share house, or rent an apartment by the month. So the typical monthly fee for renting a room in a share house versus, say, a studio unit is usually about the same.
I see.
But if they're renting an entire bigger apartment by the month, it's a lot more. So somebody might pay, let's say, on a 20, 30 square meter apartment, somebody might pay in Tokyo maybe up to $2,000 a month. Other places, other places maybe $600 or $700 or $1,000 a month. To rent a room or a small studio apartment long term will probably cost them usually less than $1,000 a month in Tokyo. Maybe some places up to $600-$700 for those tiny little studios. Other cities can be as low as $200, $300, $400 a month. So it's a big difference. So nobody wants to stay in a monthly situation for long. Usually the people who rent it out are either tourists who are going somewhere for the winter or the summer. So these might be foreigners, might be Japanese who are business owners and have a bit more flexibility. Not many of those. It might be people relocated by a company for a project. So a company sends a Japanese staff member to another city for 3, 4, 6 months a year. And then they'll rent a place by the month because they don't want to start furnishing the place and getting appliances and stuff like that. Hello? Yeah, lost you there.
So I think it just actually getting a call in the background. Yeah, sorry.
You're right. Well, where did you lose me?
So I think we were talking about the differences in price rental monthly rent.
The types of tenant. Did you hear the types of tenants that I was describing?
No, I missed the end of it a little bit.
Okay, so when you're doing monthly mention, the general tenant profiles you're going to get are either businessmen that have been relocated by a company for a short project, so up to a year. The company doesn't want to commit to a long-term lease. They don't want to start buying furniture and appliances, so they rent a place by the month for that period of time. It might be tourists who are going to a particular city for a season, so somebody who's coming to ski somewhere or coming to enjoy Tokyo for 3 months or going to enjoy the beach for a month or two. Or people that have just moved to the city and are still looking for a long-term place or are still need to show some income before they'll be able to qualify for a long-term lease, that sort of thing.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
And again, they all pay in advance, so there's no deadbeats. Nobody can afford to not pay the rent and move into a monthly mansion. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think that's actually... some of the things I've been considering, I think it makes more sense for to look at a monthly mansion type of setup.
Yep.
So, we can look at the... Maybe I'll try to look at the more options within that, within this criteria. My earlier searches or when I was inquiring about the properties was more towards looking at opportunities at the short-term rental at the Minpaku setup. So I think given the new information, I'll try to look at the apartments. Maybe there might be a lot of apartments that are probably more profitable in terms of the cash flow.
I was gonna suggest maybe for your first investment, maybe play it a bit more safe and stable and go for an apartment, and then once you're more experienced with that, you can look at a house as a second investment, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, yeah. That does sound like it's better in terms of just to be on the safe side to get more familiar with having a property in Japan. I think that does make sense.
Okay, that's probably it from us for today. We'll save you the end of that conversation, which was just discussing administrative things like how to sign up for us to represent him here in Japan and forms and legalities and that sort of thing. Hope you've enjoyed that one. I think it answered a lot of the questions that we've been getting on a regular basis and hopefully gives you an idea of how we consult to clients and potential clients at every stage of the process. Again, these sort of conversations with us do not cost you anything. So do feel free to contact us, ask us anything you want, schedule a call to discuss details or any particular strategy that you've got in mind. We are always happy to talk shop with anyone. I keep saying this, but it's true, as you've heard in this conversation. Hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Please do leave us your comments, your questions, anything that you'd like to say in the comment section of wherever you might have found us. And as usual, we would really, really appreciate it if you could leave us a rating or a review on the iTunes store, on Stitcher, wherever you might have found us. And last but not least, if you've got any questions of your own, but you don't have the time for a lengthy conversation like this one, send it to us in audio or video format, and we'll feature you on the podcast and answer your question or questions over a lengthy period of time without you actually having to be there live for it. You can just listen in and tune in whenever you're ready to hear the answers. Hope to have you with us next time. And until then, from all of us here at NTI, we wish you, as always, happy investing.